Moving on then to our next section, I know Mary talked about the restricted Knox-Keene licensing as one of the initiatives and undertakings at the department. Huge undertaking that goes along with some of the oversight around risk-bearing organizations. And today we have a special panel that will be speaking to this issue. We're excited to have them with us today on this topic. And I think there's, again, a lot of unknowns, a lot of learning. But again, I think a real opportunity for our industry. So first we'll have Bill Barcelona, who is the Executive Vice President for Government Affairs at the American Physician Groups Association. We have Amber Kemp, who is the Vice President of Healthcare Coverage for the California Hospital Association. And also Christina Wu, who serves as the Director of Regulatory Affairs for the California Association of Health Plans. So with a big round of applause, we'll bring them up and get our panel started.
Testing. Yeah, we're good. Good morning, everybody. Hi. Another year, another hot topic. Okay, we know that we're between you and lunch. We're going to run through this simple, non-controversial topic as quickly as possible. Okay? And if anybody doesn't understand anything, please raise your hands. I'd like to get to a point where everybody in the audience raises their hands. Okay. All right. All right. I'm going to start off with a little bit of the provider group perspective on this regulation and just kind of set the table because everybody may not have dealt with this or know about it, but we have had global risk entities in California for decades now. They started up in the late 80s, early 90s. They started out as a license with waivers. They were called limited licenses for a while. And then eventually, after the moratorium was over by 2004, they were reinstituted by the DMHC as restricted licenses. And for the past 30 years, we've done them on the basis of a capitated physician group, an RBO, was adding to the professional cap stream the institutional hospital-based capitated stream, and then getting the license. So you're getting a prepaid or periodic charge, and now with the future state of the new DMHC licensure regulation, it goes beyond the traditional global capitation model to a global risk model, which encompasses more than capitation. It can include any type of payment that includes a percentage of savings or losses in which the entity shares, but combines both the institutional and professional risk in some manner. So, what are the implications of this new rule? We have a handful of restricted licenses in California right now. A number of entities have filed for exemption since this regulation has been implemented this past July. Are we going to see a lot more restricted health plans arising in California over the next few years? So this regulation, as I stated, was effective on July 1st of this year, and basically the new definition states any person who assumes global risk shall obtain a license to operate a healthcare service plan. No exceptions, except there are many exceptions, and we'll talk about that. The regulation itself is well drafted. It includes definitions section and exemption section and process and a filing form. In terms of codifying a process that has been done on an ad hoc basis for the past 30 years, this regulation does a very good job of providing clarification around the filing process to become a restricted licensee. The catch for the industry at this point in time is figuring out who falls within the ambit of this regulation and who might be able to obtain an exemption based on the degree of risk relative to the total book of that entity's business. The department also issued guidance just shortly before the July 1 implementation period, and the guidance provides even more explanation about how you can obtain a temporary exemption. So if you have contracts that could fall with under the new global risk definition, such as a dual risk arrangement with a risk pool, maybe you're in an ACO that has some shared savings on the back end, and you think you might fall under this regulation or you're not sure, you can apply for an automatic exemption with the department, and you're granted that through the dependency of your contract. A lot of folks renewed their contracts before the July 1 implementation date and thus put off the entire process until their contract renews 2 or 3 years from now. This is what the two key documents look like, the regulation and the guidance document. You can obtain them online. They're quick reads and they're fairly understandable. So global risk, if you're not familiar with the term now, and this is just specific to California, a lot of other states use different global risk terms, but this is a combination of the professional and institutional risk for doctors and hospitals, but also a prepaid or periodic charge. However, it can occur either at the beginning or at the end of the period, and that's new. That's the distinction. Capitation is always paid at the beginning of a period. Some shared savings models include true-ups that impose some level of risk at the end of a period, and now this is covered as well. So this regulation affects all contracts that are issued or amended or renewed after July 1 of this year. So as I said, a lot of people have gone out and renewed their contracts prior to the implementation date, and this forestalls dealing with the new terms of the regulation until those contracts materially change or are renewed at a later date. But once you auto-renew, it triggers the scrutiny for filing. Let me take a minute. Do either of you two have a comment you want to make at this point? Or?
We're pleased that the department did work with stakeholders on the implementation guidance, and we'll talk more, I guess, at the end of the presentation about some of the work CHA did leading up to that implementation guidance.
Okay.
Thank you. So I, as Bill mentioned, value-based purchasing or risk arrangements aren't new, and I think that there's just a lot of interest by part of the health plans to understand which types of entities have gotten exemptions or require a license, and I think really looking forward to see what the DMHC says in their second round of guidance and certainly how it impacts health plans and their contracts with their providers and with their facilities.
Great. Okay. So who gets a license now? Traditionally, for the past 30 years, it's been RBOs who have obtained the license so they can add institutional cap to their professional cap payment streams. In the last few years, integrated health systems have begun obtaining RKKs. Some other entities, such as FQHC clinic models, have tried to obtain these licenses. I don't think they've had much success so far. So typically, now you're going to be looking at ACOs, and that presents some interesting differences, because a lot of ACOs don't employ a single entity such as an RBO would. They're usually a combination of hospitals, providers, more loosely knit organizations. They look more like an IPA than they do an integrated entity, for example. And in fact, the DMHC has stated in the guidance that in certain full risk arrangements that include risk pools, you may have to have both the hospital and the RBO seeking an RKK to continue to operate that shared risk arrangement. So that can get kind of confusing in terms of how each entity would be reporting financial information that may differ over time from the other partner in that relationship. Why did the DMHC adopt this regulation? That's a good question. There was certainly a need to have a written rule around how you obtain a restricted license. This has been done, as I said, on an ad hoc basis for the last 30 years, and so there was some variation. You have a couple of limited licenses from the 1990s that are still operating in California, and then you have a lot of restricteds that have come up since 2004 to deal with the Medicare Advantage market through global capitation, percentage of premium arrangements. But now there's a push to extend restricted licenses into the Medicaid market, into Medi-Cal managed care. We're seeing a few more filings, entities that are working in that area. And you have this new phenomenon of PPO ACOs in California and self-funded employers who are also doing this. And so there was concern, I think, at least expressed by the DMHC in the review process over this regulation, around the financial solvency of all of these types of new risk-bearing models that are out there. And this regulation allows the DMHC to obtain a lot of information from the industry about the nature of the contracts and where they are. And indeed, you have to file your financial information when you seek an exemption from the rule. And that gives the DMHC the ability to gather large amounts of market data to determine where it wants to go in the future. That's uncharacteristic for a Knox-Keene regulation to be used as a tool to gather market information rather than to just provide clarity and consistency in the implementation of a law. But it was approved, and it is now a rule that has to be followed. All right. Alongside this regulation, there was a companion regulation around RBO financial requirements. SB 260 had been implemented, it had been passed back in the 1999 legislative session when a lot of groups were going out of business. It was implemented around 2005 and has been in place ever since then. It created the Financial Solvency Standards Board. It created RBO financial solvency filing. Had not been updated in a decade. And so this regulation came along at the same time, which now requires T&E at the RBO level to be boosted quite a bit. And it has become operative in October of this year, but really the new standards for RBOs to meet won't be live until a year from October. But you compare that to the restricted license T&E requirements on the right-hand side of the slide, and you'll see that you've got some level of parity on both ends. So if you're an RBO and you're getting into the global risk market, you're going to have requirements as an RBO for increased capitalization, and you're going to have them on the other side if, in fact, the DMHC deems that your full risk arrangement, for example, requires licensure. You're going to end up with kind of a double requirement for T&E solvency, and you're going to have to come up with a lot greater level of capitalization and sequester that money away from your regular operations. So this duplication is going to tie up a lot of capital across the industry at the provider group level. This is not something that we've seen before. Typically, provider groups operate in a very lean fashion. IPAs, for example, disgorge a lot of their profits back to the physicians at the end of each year. Now, with the implementation of both of these, you're going to see capital being held in a reserve status at a much higher level. I don't know if that's going to result in less operating funding for these organizations or not. It's hard to tell at this point. Impacts on health plan contracting with providers in Medicare Advantage. We don't see a lot of impact as a result of this regulation in the MA market. A lot of groups have taken on restricted licenses so they could do percentage of premium cap with MA plans in California. We think that'll continue. It's a healthy market. The number of seniors will grow. The number of duals will double in the next 10 years in California. So this is a market that's going to expand incrementally over the next decade, and we'll probably see a lot of work. And typically, over the last decade, the organizations that have been taking global risk in this market have been financially solvent and have done well. There's been no failures. Impact on traditional Medicare ACO models. This is where it starts to get interesting. When the regulation was being developed, one of the rationales that the DMHC advanced in the regulatory process as to why it needed to expand the definition of global risk was because Medicare ACO models were taking on greater risks, such as the next-gen model, and indeed now with some of the new announcements from CMMI, you're going to have geographic and global risk models in traditional Medicare that provider groups can sign on to. However, when the regulation was finally issued and the department issued its guidance document, it stated that for now it wasn't going to touch Medicare ACOs and Medicare risk-bearing models in the traditional A and B Medicare side of the market. So I would put a pin in that issue for now and say that it's very likely that DMHC will revisit this issue in the next 2 years to determine whether or not it needs to regulate risk-bearing entities. Impacts on commercial HMO. Again, RKKs have been around for a long time. Limiteds have been around for a long time. And we won't really see the true scope of this regulation's impact on that market and on the market concerning full risk arrangements for another 2 to 3 years because there were so many renewals prior to the July 1 implementation date. However, when those contracts start to come forward, it's going to be very expensive for people to obtain licenses. Right now, I think it costs anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million to obtain a restricted license once you've done all your financial and legal work. And then you've got to sequester your T&E money for your reserves, too. So whether or not this has a chilling impact on mechanisms that have generated a lot of value in California managed care or not, we don't know. Do two of you have any thoughts on that?
Well, as you mentioned, many of our providers renewed their contracts so that the regulation wouldn't apply to them. And then the regulation will apply to them once those contracts come up for renewal. The challenge there is that the department has indicated that it's looking at all of the contracts that it receives to help inform its implementation guidance going forward. So the challenge is that it's not going to see the depth and the breadth of all of the value-based contracting arrangements because folks have renewed their contracts, and so it just kind of puts us in a bind in terms of, you know, learning from those contracts that have been submitted, and then how do we revise the guidance, and there's a little bit of a time crunch there.
Yeah.
I think one thing also is that contracting can be a very long process. And so I think it will be very interesting to see how this will affect not only the specific provisions related to contracts with health plans and their delegated entities, but also potentially how long it takes. And frankly, whether or not there might be some abrasion there. So I think that definitely remains to be seen.
Yeah. You know, if you're a typical RBO and you've got 8 or 9 health plan contracts and you've got shared risk arrangements with a number of hospitals within those 8 or 9 agreements, and so then that factors out to maybe 20 or 30 shared risk arrangements, if you have to file for every one of those with the DMHC separately, which is what the regulation currently requires, it just may not be cost effective for you to continue to do those arrangements if you have to lay out the money just for the filing, not the ongoing jurisdictional compliance that follows that after you've done it. So, and that's where I think we really need to see how this plays out over the rest of this decade, maybe into the next 5 years. Commercial PPO, commercial PPO ACOs are just getting started. They're fledgling entities. They're starting to show some promise. The IHA data that is out from the Atlas shows that they hold a lot of promise in terms of controlling costs and in increasing quality of care. I don't know if the cost of licensure and regulation over those types of entities will impose a chilling effect on that market or not. It's hard to say at this point, so it's just speculation. And then impacts on self-funded arrangements. We had, APG had proposed a five-year pilot bill in the legislature to use global risk in self-funded payer arrangements that was particularly focused on union trust funds because they like HMO a lot. And that bill was vetoed by the governor at the last minute after passing the legislature at about, I think we only had 4 no votes out of 120 legislators. So it had overwhelming support in the legislature. So I'm sure that issue will come back. The need for expansion of value-based payment is critical in the California market right now and the move away from fee-for-service. So I think that's an issue that will remain pending. A lot of self-funded employer plans are experimenting with shared savings ACO models as well. The Boeing Memorial contract down in Long Beach is an example, and whether or not this regulation will end up impacting that arrangement is still an open question, hard to say. And then again, as I said earlier, it's difficult to know whether the cost of licensure and jurisdiction will chill those arrangements and shut them down, or people will just deal with it. Medi-Cal managed care, tough to say at this point. People who are doing global risk and Medi-Cal managed care with MMC plans are getting restricted anyway, and things will probably continue to develop in that area just fine, and I don't think the regulation looks to be much of an impediment at all. It seems to provide clarity around that market pretty well. We talked about ACOs. Nothing more to say on that slide. Shared risk pools, we talked about that. Here's the thing. When you look at a policy and the implementation of a policy that expands jurisdiction, here's a contrary policy. IHA data shows for the last 6 years that as you increase the risk curve among providers, when you go from no risk at fee-for-service to professional risk, to global risk, and full risk, you not only decrease out-of-pocket costs dramatically for consumers, you not only decrease total cost of care, you increase quality scores dramatically as well. So the contrary public policy here is, do we want to encourage the continued development of global risk models in this state, and does it really pose a significant financial solvency issue that warrants a greatly expanded regulatory structure? I think that's still an open issue.
I think we have some clarity, though, because we know Covered California wants to promote effective use of primary care and ACOs, integrated healthcare models, and DHCS, the Medi-Cal program, wants to promote value-based payment arrangements. So on one hand, we have these departments under the administration that are promoting value-based payment and care coordination and reducing costs, improving quality, and then the department's regulation, which potentially stifles efforts in that area. So it's definitely not aligned within the administration.
Yeah, it's a tough call. The guidance document created an expedited exemption process. To date, I think the department's indicated there are about 200 entities who've taken advantage of the expedited exemption. So they've filed their contracts with the department. The department's reviewing but they are exempted from any oversight at the present time until their contracts renew. But as part of this effort, the scope of review allows the department to take a look at those contractual relationships, not just to the extent of the financial risk that the contract poses, not to the extent that it may involve global risk or not, but for any other purpose of the application of the Knox-Keene Act as well. That's a dramatic pause.
And I think from our members, their frustration is they're under the understanding that DMHC already has access to these contracts because of the plan filing. So the plans are already reporting the arrangements under them. So DMHC has this information. Are they reviewing it? We don't know. So why, you know, the question then from our members is, why are you creating this extra burden amongst the entire healthcare industry to resubmit these contracts that you in theory already have?
Yeah. But if you're a law firm or a consulting firm, Christmas came early this year. I talked about the categorical exemptions under the guidance before. Just to go over it again, bundled payment, case rate, DRGs, per diem arrangements, CMS-based accountable care organizations in Medicare, and any CDI-licensed PPO-ACOs are wholesale exempted from the ambit of the regulation at this time, even though they may involve something that is clearly global risk under the new expanded definition. But again, there's a DMHC footnote in the guidance that says this can be revoked at any time. So the important thing to know about the guidance is it's temporary. The DMHC is reviewing contracts, and they've stated that they may issue further rules in 2020 around to provide greater clarity. We talked about the filing percentage. In addition to the 190-plus expedited exemptions, three RKKs in Orange County were issued full exemptions prior to the operative date of the regulation on July 1st. Their ongoing business with CalOptima. And the interesting thing to note there is that CalOptima is one of the oldest plans employing the use of global capitation in California. I believe that it was actually initiated in Orange County. This is where the whole restricted license global cap model began with a license of waivers back in the early 1990s. So the department was good about providing transparency, and they publish an online exemption list. Here's the link is provided for you in the copy of this in your materials. You can see who's getting exemptions. They are still coming in from time to time, and plans must still file their provider contracts, as you indicated, Amber. So there's another source of review for the department. And now, once we get through the temporary exemption process, the formal exemption process that was specified in the regulation takes hold. And this is a much more detailed process to get a formal exemption. And basically, the department has broad latitude to determine who gets an exemption and who doesn't within a certain geographic location. There are a number of factors, but they must act within 30 days once their request is filed. But you have to file a lot of information, and this is going to be very costly for entities who might fall within the ambit, such as RBOs and hospitals who have shared risk arrangements, for example. You've got to file your financial statements. You've got to show total annual percentage of annualized income. All the contracts, you've got to provide information about the geographic service area, and then the department can come back and ask for any other information that they deem is relevant, or you have the leeway to submit additional information as well. The department, in reviewing the exemption, will look at the level of risk that's being brought into a certain marketplace by the assumption of global risk by an entity, the portion of the market share that they're assuming for global risk versus the rest of their business, their financial capacity, all of those things make sense. the potential impact on the healthcare marketplace in a region where one operates, with an eye toward what would happen in that marketplace if the entity went bankrupt. And this kind of harkens back to the late 1990s when a lot of organizations closed their doors, whether they were health plans or what later became known as RBOs. And this has an eye toward that circumstance. Whether or not that circumstance could replicate itself now, 35 years later or whatever, is questionable because we've had so much progress under the SB 260 financial solvency structure. But in any event, you have to prove a lot, and the department has broad leeway to either grant your exemption or require you to get a license. Now, if you're in a contract or you're trying to negotiate a contract and you are filing this, it's a little bit clunky in terms of how you negotiate this agreement with a health plan, get through the exemption process, maybe get denied, face licensure, and how that all works logistically. I have a lot of sympathy for contracting people in trying to make this work. Less sympathy for law firms and consultants because they're going to make a boatload of money off of this regardless.
And just want to point out that the criteria that the department outlined, it's very subjective, right? Providers have no idea internally what criteria the department's really looking at, and they really need that finality and that clarity to understand whether or not they need to proceed with submitting an exemption request.
And just a note here in terms of precedent, the three full exemptions that I referenced earlier in Orange County, the orders granting those exemptions did not list any analysis relative to these factors. So it's a blank slate in terms of what the department may publish in the future around, you know, that would create a precedent or an understanding across the industry as to how one goes about getting a successful full exemption under the regulation. We've outlined most of this. It's cost, it's uncertainty, and does it really drive value in the marketplace or does it... So anyway, let me turn it over to you, Christina, for the health plan perspective.
Thank you very much, Bill, and thank you, Amber. So as Mary mentioned in her presentation, plans are subjected to delegation oversight requirements. So if you delegate any responsibility to another entity, the health plan is ultimately responsible to make sure that A, the entity is doing what they say they're doing, and second of all, that if the entity fails to perform any of those duties, that it is the health plan's responsibility to take care of the member, make sure that they're made whole. And so I think where the delegation oversight sort of runs into all of this is that, well, if the health plan, which is a Knox-Keene licensed entity, is supposed to make sure that their delegated entities are following the laws, whose responsibility is it to make sure that the delegated entity has reviewed their contracts, determine whether or not they should apply for a license or if they should apply for an exemption? And ultimately, how is the DMHC going to communicate either with the plan or with the facility or the provider group about what their determination is, and how does that flow back up to the health plan? So I think that that's definitely a question that remains to be answered, and hopefully we can work together with our trade association partners and with the department to find more information about that. And then, you know, as Bill mentioned, the DMHC did update the RBO regulations. And so it's actually more difficult to become an RBO now. There are more stringent financial requirements. And so for that reason, you may or may not see disruptions or different types of contracting arrangements that might need to happen in order for an entity to meet the new RBO requirements. And also specifically related to finances, DMHC is conducting their review of an exemption or a licensure requirement based on contracts. So they're saying it's a contract by contract basis. Well, health plan contracts are written to include more than one type of risk payment. You know, you might have capitation plus shared savings, or, you know, a plethora. Second of all, health plan contracts may include more than one line of business. So where the DMHC has exempted, for example, CDI lines of business, how does that change the way that you may need to renew or renegotiate your contract? Do you segment that out? Is the DMHC going to include, you know, CDI, which they had already exempted in their review? And third of all, it also includes Medicare Advantage as well. And so to the extent that, for example, a health plan has multiple lines of business with multiple products, and you know, maybe they have an ACO, a Medicare ACO with a particular provider group, you know, how all of that is going to be reviewed, what information, or how is the health plan responsible for making these types of determinations in terms of who needs to get a license, who doesn't need to get a license. And also, I think there are questions about whether or not a limited Knox-Keene or restricted Knox-Keene license currently meets the requirements of this regulation. So they are they may not necessarily, these types of limited Knox-Keene licenses, licensees, may have certain responsibilities such as like claims processing or utilization management, but that don't actually have enrollment or marketing you know, responsibilities like a health plan does. Are these types of entities required to now get a full license with the DMHC? And so I just think definitely, like Amber and Bill mentioned, there's a lot of ambiguity, and I think it will be interesting for the health plans to see, first of all, how their contracting negotiations may be affected, what may be affected from a delegation oversight perspective, how do you know that an entity is supposed to be applying for a license or not. And lastly, certainly with respect to these, the updated financial solvency regulations for risk-bearing organizations, I think it'll be interesting to see how that all changes or affects or delays some of the contracting with health plans and their entities. So I'll turn it over to Amber.
Thank you. So I think Bill and Christina provided a lot of great background, so I'm going to skip the background here and just get right to the legislation that we sponsored this year, Senate Bill 714. We sponsored this legislation as a holistic fix to the regulation. Our members were really frustrated. We had commented through the regulation comment process. It was a 4 rounds of public comment, and each time the department didn't accept the feedback that we provided, wouldn't engage in discussions with stakeholders because they were in the middle of the regulatory process. We were not included in the pre-regulatory discussion stakeholder engagement process. So our members were really upset because they're like, the train is going, and the department's not even listening to any of the feedback that stakeholders are providing. So our only recourse was to introduce legislation. And what we did was we essentially took our comment letter and put it in a bill, right? Everything that we had said to the department, here we go, we want to have this discussion with stakeholders. Everyone should be a part of this discussion, the physician groups, the health plans, consumer advocates. And what we found was everyone was just chomping at the bit to have this discussion. The department, after the regulation was promulgated, was willing to engage in that discussion with us as well. And what we learned was that stakeholders were pretty unified in terms of what payment arrangements should be presumptively exempt from the regulation. And those are exactly the payment arrangements that are found in the implementation guidance. The unfortunate part is those arrangements are only exempt at this time. It's very flexible and fluid. The department can change their mind tomorrow about that. So we hope that in the new year, when we continue our discussions with the department, when they've reviewed more contracts and have a better understanding of the various types of value-based payment arrangements, that they will be more open and receptive to making those payment arrangements exempt permanently. And if not, then legislation is another recourse that we'll have to consider, because our members would like some clarity and finality regarding that process, and we don't believe that the department should have that open-ended jurisdiction of all of these, you know, smaller payment arrangements. We also introduced a concept that we've seen with CMS and in New York. It's where you look at a qualitative threshold. So you look at the percent at risk, and you compare it to the maximum annual revenue of an organization or its sponsoring affiliate across all payers. Or you look at the percentage at risk, and you compare it to an organization or their sponsoring affiliate's tangible net equity or cash at hand. And you do an analysis, and it's, you know, this is something that stakeholders were open to discussing, even the consumer advocates. They agreed, not the department doesn't need to review every contract. Let's have that discussion. So stakeholders agreed to have that discussion. The department agreed to table that discussion until it reviewed all the contracts that were submitted during this time period. And so we're hopeful that the department will have that discussion with stakeholders. We believe this is such an important issue that everyone is so willing to come together, do some more education. We're all aligned in agreeing that value-based care is so important. Improving care coordination, improving quality, reducing costs is critical to achieving affordability in the long run. And we really need to just pause and have this important discussion about how the department's approaching this. So we see our legislation as being very successful in just getting stakeholders to the table and having those discussions that should have occurred in the beginning, or, you know, a pause button should have been pressed during the regulatory process when it was evident that there were so many stakeholders who were just not okay with where the department was going. That being said, would like to thank the department because once they promulgated the regulation, they were very helpful and they were willing to come to the table and have these discussions, and they've been very accessible to our members, to our collective members, and having these discussions. So we look forward to our continued partnership with the department to work on this regulation and continue discussion with stakeholders that we believe are just critical discussions to have at this point in California. Pause there to see if there's anything from my colleagues before we take questions from the group.
Yeah. Well, just one last thought. The market's currently consolidated around five large health plans that have over 90% of the enrollment in the state, and yet there are about 100 full-service plans listed on the department's website. If you add another 200 or 300 full-service plans as a result of this regulation, my question is whether it will really generate any value or increased quality of care or result in any decrease of cost to the marketplace over time. And that's really the thought I want to leave you all with today.
And I guess to add to that, I would have liked the department to have done something similar to Covered California, where Covered California, before they implement a policy, they're trying to ensure everything's evidence-based, right? They're issuing 300 pages reports for all stakeholders to review. They're letting you know in advance, this is where we're getting our rationale, it's evidence-based, and this is why we're proposing this policy change. It would have been nice for the department to undertake that process as well, so that we can have a really informed discussion.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.